Well, to begin, I want to introduce someone who is very familiar to the Council for National Policy to introduce our first presidential candidate today. Morton Blackwell is a longtime member, in fact, was the executive director of the Council for National Policy. He served as the executive director from 1991 to 2000. He is the founder and the president of the Leadership Institute. He is a leader in the conservative movement. He is a friend of mine, a friend of conservatives across the country. He and Helen live in Arlington, Virginia. Please welcome Mr. Morton Blackwell to introduce our first guest.
Let me just give you the case you forgot or you were not here last time. Our format is this. Our candidates will speak for 20 minutes. Then we will take questions from the floor. We had solicited questions from our membership. We have gone through those questions. We have categorized those questions. And you have been contacted if you are going to be one of many who are going to be asking questions. So I will come back after the 20-minute mark. I will moderate, recognize you to ask that question. And then we will have a lightning round of questions with our candidates. So just wanted to make sure that that was clear. Thank you, Morton.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Tony. A pleasure for me, as usual, to come to the Council for National Policy, which is a vitally important organization for our country and does more good, shall I say, than is publicly apparent. It is my honor to have been asked to introduce our first presidential candidate. Dr. Rand Paul ran for office as a libertarian leading Tea Party conservative in 2010, taking on much of this town in the process, and he won a huge underdog victory. He has become a leading champion of conservative causes in D.C. He was named the most fiscally conservative senator by the National Taxpayers Union. He has authored a five-year balanced budget plan combined with the nearly $3 trillion flat tax reform. He has stood up for the unborn as a sponsor of the Life at Conception Act and secured a Senate vote on defunding Planned Parenthood. And that was after turning the tables and confronting the Democrats on an issue that too often has Republicans ducking and weaving. He's a champion of the Second Amendment and the sponsor of a national right to work law. He filibustered in the Senate twice to stand up for the entire Bill of Rights and against the Obama administration's abuses of power. A career doctor, not a career politician, he has led the fight for term limits and for reforming Washington. Perhaps most interesting, he has done all this while carrying his message beyond traditional Republican audiences, to downtown Detroit, to Hispanic charter schools, and to college campuses everywhere. I spent a great deal of my life and still do working with college students, and I can testify to you that he personally has a lot of young people, and in fact, it is in my judgment unmistakable that Senator Rand Paul has more identified and active college student supporters than any other candidate in this presidential race. I thank him for the things he has done for conservative organizations, including my Leadership Institute, where he's been generous in his assisting the Institute programs. And finally, we all know personnel is policy. And several of the top positions at Rand's campaign and his super PAC are staffed by longtime friends, students of mine, and conservative movement leaders whom you all know well. Rand Paul is the real deal, and I'm happy to introduce him to you today.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Probably no one in the country has done more to create the next generation of leaders than Morton Blackwell. So we should be very thankful for what he's done with the Leadership Institute. The question I'd like to present to you today is, are liberty and virtue incompatible? Are liberty and virtue mutually exclusive? I think the answer is unequivocally no. I think from our founding fathers understood that to have liberty required virtue. Washington talked about democracy requiring a virtuous people. My friend Don Devine has written in a book, he says that freedom needs tradition. What does he mean by that? He said freedom needs tradition for law and order, for inspiration. But the reverse is also true, that tradition, conservatism, needs freedom as well to escape stagnation, to escape coercion. The way Don Devine puts it is he says that this was the ultimate thing that the founding fathers discovered, was that the synchronism of freedom and tradition together. One of my favorite authors is Oz Guinness, and he wrote a book called The Suicide of a Free People. And in that, he said that liberty requires restraint, but the only restraint consistent with freedom is self-restraint. There's a lot in that one sentence. Liberty requires restraint, but the only restraint consistent with liberty is self-restraint. We sometimes think that libertarians are somehow at odds with conservatism. But you know, Ronald Reagan said the very heart and soul of conservatism was libertarianism. Get back, it's this whole freedom and tradition. Now, there have been wars, and some of you may remember the wars from the early days of National Review, and the libertarians fought with the conservatives and kind of went into their own corners. But there were also people all along who wanted to find a middle ground between libertarianism and conservatism. Some called it fusionism. Myers, who wrote with National Review, tried to have a foot in each camp and tried to say that there really wasn't an incompatibility here. But I do think that liberty is inversely proportional to the size of government. I think as government grows larger, your liberty grows smaller. In fact, I tell people there are two reasons why we should all want small government, the smallest government possible. One is the liberty argument. The liberty argument is kind of what Thomas Paine put forward. Thomas Paine said that government is a necessary evil. And you're like, oh my goodness, he's saying government's evil. It's not that evil. I'm part of government now, so it can't be terrible. But it is a necessary evil. Why? Because you have to give up some liberty. How do you give up your liberty? You give up your liberty through your sweat equity, through taxes. When Bob McEwen gives his speech, he'll say, if you're 100% taxed, you're 0% free. And that's true. So we give up some of our sweat equity to establish government. This is not an argument for no government, but it is an argument for keeping government as small as possible. So if you're 100% taxed, you're 0% free. If you're kind of where we are now, 50% taxed, 50, you're sort of half free, half slave. And that's kind of where we are now. But you want to keep government small because you have to give up liberty. The other reason to keep government small is what I call the efficiency argument. And this is what Milton Friedman put forward. Milton Friedman said that nobody spends somebody else's money as wisely as their own. There's a real truism there. Do you think any government official lays awake at night when they lose money? If I ask any of you for $1,000, you'll think about, well, I had to earn $2,000 to have $1,000 left, and if I'm going to invest in something, I have to think long and hard about what it cost me in my labor to get $1,000. But if you were a politician and I ask you for $1,000 or $1 million or $1 billion, it doesn't make a difference because it's not their money. So it's not that government is inherently stupid, although it's a debatable question. They just don't get the right signals. It's not their money, so they can never be as frugal or as wise with their money. So you want government to be as small as possible. But that leads us to where we are now in Washington. didn't they say, elect us, we'll be the Republicans, we'll be in charge, and then you'll get what you want, smaller government. Does anybody think government's getting smaller? I think it's getting bigger. So you have a Republican House and a Republican Senate, and we can't do anything. But here's the real sad thing. We can't cut out $500 million for Planned Parenthood, but we will get together and raise the debt ceiling. Not me, but other Republicans will. So what are we using our leverage for? And now some are saying, well, we should get rid of the filibuster. The filibuster's a problem. I disagree. The supermajority requiring 60 votes in the Senate could be used to our advantage. How would we do it? Let all the spending expire. The spending expires automatically every year. We don't have to defund Planned Parenthood. It expired on September 30th. If we would not have restarted it, we wouldn't have Planned Parenthood funding. In fact, when it expires, you say you want to restart it? Go for it. Take 60 votes now to restart it. We should do that with everything in government. It's not just about Planned Parenthood. There are thousands. That's probably the most offensive spending, I think, in the budget. But there are thousands of wasteful programs. I'll give you a couple of examples. We spent $800,000 in the last couple years on developing a televised cricket league for Afghanistan. Really? They don't even have TVs in Afghanistan. 1 in 10,000 people have a television in Afghanistan. But I don't care if they've all got TVs. We don't have the money to do silly stuff like that. We're borrowing money from China to send it to Afghanistan for televised cricket. We spent $250,000 last year on bringing 24 kids from Pakistan to send them to space camp in Alabama. Really? We don't have money for this kind of stuff. Let it all expire and tell them you want that kind of junk, you've got to get 60 votes. Use the supermajority that's required in the Senate for anything to our advantage. We spent a couple $100,000 studying Japanese quail to see whether or not they're more sexually promiscuous when they're on cocaine. I think we could have just polled the audience and saved the money there. But when you bundle all of the spending into one thing you call a continuing resolution, you're continuing more of the same. Nothing gets reformed, the debt continues to accumulate, and it accumulates at about $1 million every minute. So I see such great inertia and such great attachment to the status quo, I'm ready to say enough's enough. Let it all expire and tell the people who want to spend money, they've got to get 60 votes to restart it. When you get outside the Beltway and you enter into America, you find that people are unhappy with Washington and that Washington is completely disconnected. And I'll give you an example of how disconnected. I'm on the Foreign Relations Committee, so I put forward an amendment that said we should not send foreign aid to any country that persecutes Christians. Seems pretty reasonable to me. You would think, who would be opposed to that? And you might say, well, how do you define persecution of Christians? Well, pretty easy to define, actually. If a country has the death penalty or life imprisonment for criticism of the state religion, they call it blasphemy, but it's criticism of the state religion, apostasy, conversion, basically conversion from Islam to Christianity, or death penalty or life imprisonment for interfaith marriage. There's about 25 or 30 countries that have all of these laws. Most of them have contributed to the Clinton Foundation, by the way. So I introduced this in committee, and I think, well, gosh, this should be a no-brainer. I should be able to get this through pretty quickly. The vote was 18-2. Every Democrat and virtually every Republican voted to continue sending foreign aid to these countries. You know what their argument is? Oh, this is how we project our power. This is how we exert our influence around the world. We don't give the money to the radicals. We give the money to the moderates that are pro-America. And I said, well, after the Afghan war, they put in a constitution, right, in Afghanistan that has the death penalty for conversion to Christianity, death penalty for interfaith marriage, and death penalty for criticism of the state religion. How much influence did we get? I've got an op-ed coming out this week that is called Iraq the Ingrate. It starts out with, how sharper than a serpent's tooth is a thankless ally. We spent $1 trillion in Iraq. 4,486 of our best young men and women died there. And what's Iraq? Who's Iraq's best ally right now? Iran. Who's their second best ally? And it's a close call. Russia. Who gave Russia permission to fly over Iraq recently to bring more troops and weapons into Syria? Iraq. But this is where we may be divided a little bit, but it's important that you hear this. Many in our party, many presidential nominees are saying, we need a no-fly zone over there. Hillary Clinton's for it too. Everybody seems to be for a no-fly zone. So we're going to have a no-fly zone over a space where people are already flying. What does that mean? How do you have a no-fly zone over an area where people are already flying? That means you're going to shoot them down. Who's flying over this space? Iraq and Syria have invited Russia. I'm not saying it's a good idea, but they have invited Russia, and Russia is currently flying over the space that Carly Fiorina, Rubio, Hillary Clinton, they all want to have a no-fly zone over there, over a space Russia's already flying in. Everybody says, oh, I'm the next Ronald Reagan. I'm the reincarnation of Ronald Reagan. But if you study Ronald Reagan and you think about and look at what his foreign policy was, he would never do this. He would never say, we need to have a confrontation. We need to be prepared to use force right now against Russia. We spent 70 years trying to avoid a confrontation with Russia. And you know what? We outlasted them. And in the end, you know why we won the Cold War? And this is incredibly important because we've got a lot of craziness and crazy people running around chasing after Uncle Bernie. We won the Cold War because the engine of capitalism defeated the engine of socialism. Bernie's running around the country saying, you want free education? You want free cars? You want free clothes? You want free movies? You want whatever you want, we'll give it to you for free. And it's like, he's missing out on the part of socialism that should have us all really animated. Socialism is against choice. See, the Democrats say they're the party of choice, but socialism is about taking away choice. Light bulbs, that's just the tip of the iceberg. Toilets, refrigerators, washing machines, but you go on to the means of production. If you want to produce anything, you got to get permission from the state. If you want to buy anything, you got to get permission from the state. And really, there's one fundamental thing about socialism, and this is what brought down the Soviet Union, brought down the Soviet Empire, and condemns all socialism to failure. They cannot determine something as simple as the price of bread. Think about it. You set the price too low, the bread's all gone. You got famine. You set the price too high, the bread rots on the store shelf, or there develops a black market. Nobody can know the correct price. Why? There is no correct price other than what the market determines. The beauty of capitalism, as recognized by Adam Smith when he said, your supper is not brought by the benevolence of the brewer and the baker. Your supper is brought by their self-interest. But it's their self-interest in trying to provide for their family that, as a secondary consequence, brings great distribution of products and wealth. We are the world's richest country in all time. But if we can't explain to the next generation how we got here and what made us great, you know, people are talking about make America great again, but if you don't know what made America great to begin with, how are we going to do it? It scares me probably more than anything else, this groundswell of support for socialism in our country. It still boggles my mind. Does anybody maybe not remember, we're all too young for this, but after World War II, when Churchill is defeated by a socialist in England, how did that happen? How did somebody who helps win the war over there get defeated by socialism? Because the allure of free stuff is difficult to overcome. Our job is always more difficult. We have to sell our ideas 10 times better than the other side, because if they're selling a cell phone and we're selling opportunity, we've got to be pretty good at what we're selling. We also have to know and believe in what made us great, in our founding documents. when I look out and I look at the field and I say, and frankly, people have been saying this, why are you doing this? Why are you still doing this? There needs to be a voice for reason. There needs to be a fiscally conservative voice. And I don't say this to be presumptuous, but I'm the only fiscal conservative in the race. Why? Because you cannot be fiscally conservative if you're for unlimited spending for any aspect of government. There really has to be conservatism in spending, whether it's for military or for domestic welfare. The unholy alliance in Washington is that right and left secretly get together and they raise both. One of the worst things that happened in this town was 2 years ago when Paul Ryan and Patty Murray got together and they got rid of the sequester. People said, oh, we can't have a strong military and sequester. Craziness. Yes, sure you can. All the sequester did was slow down the rate of growth of spending. It did not cut defense spending. It got rid of the, it slowed down the rate of growth. And I introduced legislation saying, you know what? If the sequester is a hardship on the military and doesn't give them enough freedom, I said, let's take $50 billion and let them move it wherever they want so it isn't across the board within the military. Let them shift it to where they want to spend it or don't want to spend it. But the military is like anything else. Those of you who were in the military, I defy you to look at me with a straight face and say there's not waste in the military. John Lehman was the youngest Secretary of Navy under Reagan, and I have a great deal of respect for him. He advised Romney, and Romney got half the message. He advised Romney that we needed a bigger Navy. I'm fine with that. If we need a bigger Navy, we need a bigger Navy. But you know what John Lehman said? He said we'd pay for it by getting rid of bureaucracy at the Pentagon. We are a bigger and more diverse nation with every new day. We are not going to win again, and I promise you this is true. We are not going to win again by saying, we're going to get more of the Caucasian vote. And I know that's not somebody's stated purpose, but that seems to be what's happening. And some people think, yeah, we can just win by getting more of our base out. No, we need to get new people into our base. We need new people to come into our party. I tell people, we need people, rich, poor, white, black. We need people with tattoos, with earrings, without earrings. We need a whole cross-section of new people. Liberty's popular to a lot of people. We go on college campuses and the liberty we preach to them is your government shouldn't take your phone records without a warrant. That big government shouldn't be collecting your records because after your phone records, they'll come for your gun records. After your gun records, they're coming into your house to investigate your religious beliefs. It's all part of the same scheme, and we should stop it. We need to be the party that defends the entire Bill of Rights, and when we are, I think we will be the party that can win again. We're great on the Second Amendment. I tell people, if you don't believe I'll defend the Second Amendment, come into my house unannounced. But we need to defend the First Amendment, the right to express ourselves, but also religious liberty. We need to defend the Fourth Amendment, which is the right to be left alone in our house without the government coming in unless there's evidence, unless there's a warrant with our name on it. But we also need to be the party of the Fifth and Sixth Amendment. I call these the Justice Amendments. The Fifth Amendment says they can't take your property without due process. When you get Mr. Trump here, ask him about his love for eminent domain and how he uses it in his business model to take property from small property owners for himself. The Sixth Amendment says you should have a right to a trial by jury. And you say to yourself, who could possibly be against that? Well, we had a debate in 2011 over this, and the law of the land as we speak is that an American citizen can be detained indefinitely without a lawyer. Well, we were having this debate, and I don't like to make it personal, but with the senator from Arizona. I asked him incredulously on the Senate floor, I said, do you mean an American citizen could be plucked up for an accusation alone in our country, and sent to Guantanamo Bay? He said, yep, if they're dangerous. Sort of begs the question, doesn't it? Who gets to decide who's dangerous and who's not? And I was thinking to myself at that moment of Richard Jewell. You remember Richard Jewell? Everybody said he was the Olympic bomber. Everybody said that he had exploded this bomb. He met the profile. He had glasses. I see a few of you. He had a backpack. He was solicitous to the victims. I don't know why that's a characteristic, you know. But everybody said he did it, but he didn't do it. But I was thinking, what if Richard Jewell had been a black man in the South in 1920? That's why we have the Bill of Rights, to defend minority rights. People say, well, you're not a minority. You can be a minority because of the color of your skin or the shade of your ideology. You can be a minority because you teach your kids at home. You can be a minority because you're an evangelical Christian. You can be a minority because you don't believe in God, or you can be a minority because you believe in the Constitution. We need to defend individual rights, and we can't be so careless with our freedom that in the fear of terrorism, we say, any accusation is fine, just haul them on off. Some of the characteristics that your government promotes as being potentially dangerous that you should report your neighbor if they do this are likes to spend in cash, likes to use cash, has changed the color of your hair. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands on that. Has multiple weapons in the house. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands on that one either. But if those are the characteristics of a terrorist, my goodness, wouldn't you want your day in court? Wouldn't you want a trial? Wouldn't you want a lawyer? Are we so careless with our freedom that we would give up one of the most fundamental rights, the right to a trial by a jury? I'd like to end with one story that goes along the same vein. The Sixth Amendment also says you have a right to a speedy trial. You're not supposed to rot in jail with an accusation. Khalif Browder was a 16-year-old black kid from the Bronx. He was accused of a crime, and he was sent to Rikers Island. He was there for 3 years without a trial. Two of the 3 years, he was put in solitary confinement. He was beaten by gangs and by guards, and who knows what else happened to him. He first tried to commit suicide in prison, and then was let out but could never recover from whatever happened to him in prison, and then finally did commit suicide. Never tried, kept in prison for 3 years. My message to you is, you want to win the ideas of liberty, religious freedom, limited government, you want to win those ideas, and you want to have a big enough crowd to actually win again, we're going to win again when we defend the Sixth Amendment with the same passion we defend the Second Amendment. That's the party I want to be part of, and I hope you do too. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks. All right. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Senator. Okay, we have a number of our members that over the course of the last few months, anticipating you coming along with the other candidates, have been working on questions that they would like to ask.
2 months? That's a long time to be working on it. These could be really hard questions.
Well, they're 12-part questions. And you have 12 seconds to answer.
Oh, well, that should be easy.
We're very generous. We're very generous as conservatives. Actually, we have a number of questions. As you understand, the family or the Council for National Policy is an umbrella of conservative groups that encompass foreign policy organizations, fiscal conservative organizations, and social policy organizations. So you'll be hearing questions, obviously, as you know, from a full spectrum of the conservative issues. And we begin with a foreign policy question from Clifton Schroeder. Clifton?
Many would argue that program defense cuts, as well as sequestration cuts that you spoke about, have been devastating to our military readiness. Additionally, that social experimentation is destroying morale in the armed forces, and there is also the perception among many that there is an all-out attack on religious liberty inside our military, which is making recruiting very difficult, if not impossible. For quality recruits. The question we have, Senator, is what would your priority actions be regarding the restoration of our military readiness?
I think when we talk about having a strong national defense, that it's not, we start the argument, I think, in the wrong context. We start with dollars instead of starting with vision. And so I think you have to start with a strategic vision of what we're going to do, what is our role, what are American interests, and have the debate over that. That being said, if you ask me what do I believe is the highest priority for spending, it would be defending the country. It's in the Constitution. It is a constitutional duty and role of the federal government. Can't be done by cities. And we sort of, I think, all have acknowledged it needs to be a federal defense of the country. And so when if I'm looking and weighing priorities, I would always say that the priority would go to national defense. But I also agree with Admiral Mullen, who said that the number one threat to our national security isn't global warming. It's, we're not televising this, are we? It isn't global warming. That's the dumbest thing I have ever heard, all right? But the number one threat to our national security is our debt. You cannot project strength from bankruptcy court. So when we're looking at it, we do have to put things in perspective. And I think the people who have really gone to town on the sequester from the conservative point of view, saying, oh my goodness, we can't live with this, I think have overstated the case. What we spend on military equals the next 14 countries combined. So we still spend a lot on military. We have, in real terms, I believe, had a 50% increase in military spending over the last decade, in real terms. So it's not like we're not spending any money. I think we could spend it more wisely, and I think we have to make some technical decisions. Do you need more people in the Army? Do you need more soldiers, or do you need more cruise missiles? Do you need more ships, or do you need more submarines? Do you need more land-based intercontinental ballistic missiles, or do you need more based on submarines? And I think these kind of discussions can happen, but I don't think it's a set dollar amount. And this is where I do have a disagreement with some conservative groups who say, absolutely, it's got to be 4% of GDP or some kind of number. I think that's starting out with a dollar sign. I mean, during World War II, what was it? 30% or 35, a third of our economy was going to national defense. So in times of war and in times of endangered country, you might spend a lot more than 4%. Is 4% what you have to always spend? I don't think you start with a number, because then you'll always have people just spending to get to the number. You have to start with what you actually need for national defense. One side item I'd just like to bring up, because you didn't really mention Major San, but I think within the military, one of the things, for goodness sakes, we ought to let our soldiers carry weapons when they walk around the base.
Senator, our next question is on the environment.
Oh, good. We just got started on global warming. I got more.
Actually, it's the social environment.
Oh, okay. All right.
And to ask that question, Bishop E.W. Jackson.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you, Senator, for being here. The Obergefell decision, of course, overturned thousands of years of human history and culture and redefined marriage for us. And many of the worst predictions by conservatives, one of which that ultimately some of us would land in jail over our disagreement, happened to Kim Davis in Kentucky, your state. The question is, well, really twofold. One is, do you believe this is now a matter of settled law that we ought to just move on? And number two, if anything would you do to try to protect the rights of conscience and freedom of religion by Christians and others who continue to hold that marriage is only a union between one man and one woman?
I think that there does come a time for resistance. And I think the time comes when government comes through the church doors and attempts to tell you what to do and believe in your church, that there will be a time for resistance. When that happened in Houston, when they had a subpoena sent out to get ministers' sermons who were objecting to same-sex unions or to a new law that was in Houston along these lines, I think that's a time in which you resist, and people should say, you're not coming in our church, and you'll arrest me before you come in my church. As far as Supreme Court decisions, I'm fascinated by a republic that can continue on and sometimes get it wrong for a long period of time, and this is why we shouldn't give up hope and still get it right at some point in time. Plessy versus Ferguson said that separate but equal was jolly well good, and we could just separate the races and they could have, you know, we'll just do it and you'll get equal education. And at that time, one of the greatest dissents was Justice Harlan, who said the Constitution is colorblind and does not countenance classes. He was right, but he was in the minority at the Supreme Court and he lost. It took 50 years to get to Brown versus the board, and then we finally got it right. I think with marriage, this will be revisited and revisited, and we should have it revisited. I will tell you the one thing, though, that worries me as much or more than anything about sort of religious liberty, and we need to be aware of, and conservatives sometimes fall into the trap of this. Many conservatives will say, we need to cut out subsidies to people by giving them a tax deduction for any of a variety of things. The danger is, if you call a tax credit or a tax deduction a subsidy and say that anybody who gets one can be regulated by the government, think about your church donations. That's what they're using. The progressives love this, but some conservatives have fallen into the trap of saying that a deduction is somehow government's money. You're not getting back some of your own. The government's giving money to the church so the government can regulate the church. This is where a lot of it stems from. But in the oral arguments in the case, they said the other worry is all the different ancillary functions of churches, schools and hospitals and all of that. And I think we continue to fight all of those in court case. With regard to Kim Davis in Kentucky, we have something called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in Kentucky, and it should allow protection for her to be accommodated for her beliefs. And I have proposed that we continue to fight that battle. That argument wasn't brought up. And if it goes back into court, that argument needs to be brought up, and we need to see if we can allow the Religious Freedom Restoration Act to actually work for us. Okay, I may not be aware of that. Does somebody want to make that point? Oh, good. Well, you know a lot more than I do about the case then. I stand corrected.
Hold for the microphone. Hold for the microphone, Matt.
I don't want to divert the question, but I just didn't want that statement to go without a response. That argument is part of the case, and it is part of the Kentucky Religious Freedom Restoration Act. That's part of the essential case. It's just that the judge has refused to rule upon that.
So he didn't actually rule on the Religious Restoration Act, Freedom Restoration Act?
Not yet.
Okay, so you think, and just from your perspective, there still will be some kind of court case and ruling on all this?
Yeah, in fact, probably another hearing will be within the next 30 days or so, but you know, part of that's up on appeal because the judge won't address the Kentucky RFRA, and that issue's on appeal, but it's also going in the lower court. But it's definitely a central part of the argument that Kentucky RFRA should exempt her based upon her deeply held religious convictions.
Good.
And by the way, Matt Staver, the attorney for Kim Davis, will be on a breaking news panel later today, so you'll be able to hear more about that case. Senator, I do want to do a follow-up to the bishop's question. In terms of religious freedom, and you talk about the church, religious freedom, do you see that as something that is this encompasses the church, or it is a right that goes to individuals where they can take wherever they go?
I think to individuals, and that's why I see the Hobby Lobby was a great decision, but it didn't go far enough because they said Hobby Lobby being very, very closely controlled by one religious family, they could allow it to happen. But no, I think any kind of business should be allowed to have religious mores that say, we don't want money going to abortion in our business.
Great, thank you. Our next question revolves around economic issues, and to ask this question is Joseph Farah. Joseph, where are you?
Hey, Rand. You touched on this question in your opening remarks, and again, I think in one of your responses, but it's really not a topic that's getting much attention in the debates by either party, and that is the question of our, you know, burgeoning debt of over $18 trillion. And a two-part question is, how would you approach this issue as president? And secondly, at what point would you say no to any suggestion about raising the debt limit?
Yeah, this is a good point. We talked a little bit about, on the continuing resolution, how we could use that in our favor to let it expire and then they would need 60 votes to get anything started. On the debt ceiling, I'm going to fight on the debt ceiling as well. It is and should be leverage for trying to get reform out of government. And it's a mistake just to keep raising it, and I won't vote to keep raising it. One of the things that, and I see several people from some of the groups that supported this in the past, was in 2011 we did something called cut, cap, and balance. I'm going to reintroduce that again. That's already, we've written it up and we're going to reintroduce that. And it's a fairly high bar, as it should be. You have to pass a balanced budget amendment, and then I'm fine with raising the debt ceiling for what it takes to balance the budget over a five-year period. But realize, and this is where the consternation should come in with Republicans in Washington, every Republican in the Senate voted for a balanced budget amendment. But about 15 will vote to actually balance the budget, will actually vote for a budget that balances. Because I've introduced a couple, and so has Mike Lee, and we usually get, I get mad at him sometimes. I told him I wasn't going to vote for his because he got one more than I got. He got 17 and I got 16, but if I wouldn't have voted for his, we would have been tied. But it tells you that only about a third of the people are willing to make the cuts. And this also goes to another issue. We've had this with military. I don't think you're a conservative if you vote for unlimited military spending that's offset. So we had an amendment put forward by Rubio and Cruz that would increase defense spending by $190 billion. And both Rubio and Cruz said that was just fine with them. The debt would increase them by $190 billion. I introduced a side-by-side amendment to say, if you're going to raise spending for the military $190 billion, you've got to cut it somewhere else. But then neither Rubio or Cruz were willing to make the cuts. It's easy to vote for spending for something you want, but it's harder to find the cuts to say, we're going to offset this so we don't become weaker as a nation by going further in debt.
Senator, we move now to a topic that I think you're very comfortable with, and that is in the issue of freedom and our freedoms as Americans. And to ask our next question is the former Attorney General of Virginia, Ken Cuccinelli.
Good afternoon, Senator. I think you can probably guess what I'm going to ask you. You've touched on it in your remarks and wanted to ask you to expand on your view of the proper balance between security and liberty, particularly as it relates to things like the NSA's government surveillance and the gathering of telephone metadata, which you've spoken frequently about. And I know the answer, but I think everybody else should hear whether you think that violates the Fourth Amendment and what ought to be done about it at the government level.
There's a couple things with the bulk collection of your phone records. Number one, the head of the intelligence agencies lied to us and said they weren't doing it. That gets, it goes a long way towards trust, and you have to have trust in your officials because they have such enormous power to look at all of your records any of the time. And then they say, oh, well, we're not looking at, we're collecting them but not looking at them, but we have to then have trust and believe them. But if they're lying to us and saying they're not even doing the program, that's a big problem. The Fourth Amendment says that you have to individualize. You have to have a name on the warrant, you have to have suspicion, and then you have to have a judge sign it. They're not doing any of that for this. They just say your records don't belong to you anymore once someone holds them. The old notion was that the government was protected from coming in your castle to get your records, and a man's house was his castle, or a woman's house was their castle. But now our records are in a cloud. Do you have any expectation of privacy there? Well, in 1928, the Supreme Court said, no, you don't have expectation of anything with your phone calls. Then in 1968, 40 years later, they changed their mind. In the late 1970s, they said you don't have an expectation of privacy in your records. I think they're wrong, but they haven't corrected that yet. But that's kind of where we are now. So there's a dispute whether or not it violates the Fourth Amendment. I think it does violate the spirit of it. And people then will argue, well, we have to give up this liberty because we need to be safe, and people are attacking us. People are attacking us, and I agree we should do everything we can to stop the people who are attacking us. But when I had this debate with Governor Christie, and I don't believe he was listening, but I said, I want to collect more records of terrorists, just less records of everybody else. What I mean by that is, it is a low bar to get a warrant. But it is a bar. It's a pretty low bar to get one. So, for example, the Boston bombers, I think they crossed a bunch of bars. It would have been easy. And had I been a judge, and even though I'm a person who believes in a lot of privacy, I would have signed a warrant to look at the Boston bombers' records. I would have also probably tried to find out whether he was leaving the country. which we didn't do. So I think we've spent billions of dollars doing mass surveillance when maybe we could have taken some of that money in direction and gone towards individuals and individualized this. I think really every attack or potential attack we've had in this country, there's been suspicion in advance. The 20th hijacker was Massawi. We had him and his computer a month before 9/11. The FBI agent who should have gotten the medal, I think we gave the medal to the head of the FBI, it should have been given to this agent, he wrote 70 letters to the FBI saying, would you let us ask for a warrant? They were never denied a warrant, we never asked for one. We should have done that, and there was a chance. When we looked at his computer, we did link to four or five of the hijackers. Malcolm Gladwell has written a statement based on sort of Herbert Simon, who has got a Nobel Prize for research, that knowledge does not equate to wisdom. You know, it's understanding the knowledge. So I read somewhere we have 800 million hours of audio. We've listened to 25% of it, you know? Let's get suspicion and let's really dig into the details of networks of terrorists. Let's don't waste time collecting everybody's, because it's an insult to us, and then we give up liberty that really we should be part of our cherished Bill of Rights.
Thank you, Senator. Our next question comes from Tim LaFever, and it's on social domestic policy. Tim?
Senator, this is a two-part question on an issue that you've dealt with in your remarks. Would you as president ever approve a budget that includes federal funding for Planned Parenthood or any other abortion providers? If no, how would you ensure that continuing resolutions for funding the government were passed without also approving funding of Planned Parenthood?
The answer is no, and the answer is also that as a senator over 5 years, I've never voted for any continuing resolution that included any money for Planned Parenthood. I've been a no vote every time. I think that the presidency, one of the biggest problems we face is that the power of the presidency has grown, and the power of Congress has diminished. We no longer have the checks and balances that we once had. That being said, the power of the presidency has mostly been used for harm as well. Government has gotten bigger and regulations have been piled on by executive order. We have never had, and I would argue this strenuously, we have never had a Republican that was elected to undo that. If I were elected, I would use every bit of power of the executive to undo the powers that have been accumulated by the executive. Regulations, taxes, anything I can do, including Planned Parenthood. But the real answer with Planned Parenthood is very simple and could occur now. This is why I don't want you to accept what the Republican leadership is telling you. They're telling you we can't get 6 votes from Democrats or 7 votes to defund Planned Parenthood. If the spending expires, tell them they need to get 60 votes to fund it. It's very easily done, just takes courage.
Thank you, Senator. We're coming up to our final 10 minutes of our time with you. I know you have to catch a flight, so we appreciate you being here with us this morning. But we're going to move into now a lightning round of questions. These questions are asked of all the candidates, and we'll ask you if you can keep your responses to 60 seconds or less. No filibustering, in other words. And you think you touched on this, but what is the single greatest threat facing our nation today?
The debt.
That's under 60 seconds? That's good. Upon election, would you rescind President Obama's executive orders, and how would you use executive orders during your presidency?
I think that's similar to the last answer, yes. And I would not only rescind his, I would go back as far as we can go back and start undoing things. I mean, this is a problem. Like the first George Bush changed the definition of wetlands, and in the stroke of a pen, doubled the amount of wetlands and doubled the amount of federal involvement in our backyard and all that. That could be undone by executive order.
Very good. In the introduction, this was touched upon by Morton Blackwell, but as we know in the movement that personnel is policy. Can you name a couple of your top advisors that are movement conservatives?
Doug Stafford leads my effort, and he worked for Right to Work for probably 15 years. His wife went to Leadership Institute. I think at one point in time I had five or six people, I can't name them all right now, that had gone to the Leadership Institute. But I am very proud of what Morton does over there, and I forget the number. The number's staggering, and the tens of thousands of kids that have gone through there, and that's ultimately how we're going to win the battle.
How does your faith impact your decision-making process, and how would it affect you if the American people elected you as president?
I pray every day for guidance. I am very much one who understands human frailty, my own included, and I think that everything that we do in government has a moral basis to it. You know, even spending money that is the next generation's money is immoral and wrong. And to me, it would affect and does affect every decision that I make.
With that in mind, do you see increasingly a hostility in this country to other Christians who want to take that same faith to their workplace, whether they be a police officer, whether they be a pharmacist or a truck driver? And if so, as president, what will you do to reverse that environment?
Well, I think we misunderstood the First Amendment to say that it's about keeping, religious people out of government. It's really about keeping government out of religion. And we just misinterpreted that over time. And look, we have a prayer every morning in the Senate and in the House when we open it up. There are many bodies of government. Every body of government, probably other than our schools, is allowed to have a prayer. And so I think we went overboard with that. And I think there are ways, definitely ways that we can allow religious people and religion. And, you know, the opening of my remarks is not only do we need to do it, it's a necessary part of a republic. You can't have a republic if 98% of the people are hoodlums. We usually have the opposite. 98% of the people are people with a religious faith who have a religious undergirding that causes them not to be criminals. I mean, that you rely on that. There aren't enough policemen to arrest us all. So we do rely on an environment that does have virtue in its people.
And so you see that as something that you would use your presidency, or use this term, the bully pulpit. Doesn't sound good going with religion to use the bully pulpit. But you would use that to protect that freedom.
Well, and also with the understanding that there are certain things government can't do.
Right.
So I think right now the number one associated factor with poverty in our country is having kids before you're married. But I'm not for a law that says you can,
but as president, you can talk about those things without passing a law.
Absolutely. And I think it's also, I always tell people, if I meet people who are pastors, you need to talk about it too, because I can't fix it. I can't necessarily fix it.
Good point. What will your leadership provide that is completely unique from the other candidates in this race vying for the presidency?
I touched on this a little bit, is that I really do believe I'm the only conservative in the race. Because to be conservative, you have to be conservative with all the money, not just some of the money. So if you believe in unlimited military spending and you want to conserve the welfare spending, I consider you to be part of the problem. And really, that's what goes on in the Capitol, is there's an unholy alliance between right and left. And because of that, we borrow $1 million a minute. And so that will ultimately be a discussion. It is what distinguishes me from others who say they are conservative, that if you're going to increase defense spending by nearly $200 billion, but you're not going to be willing to offset that with spending cuts, that's just not a conservative notion.
Traditionally, Republicans, when they come in behind a Democrat in the presidency, will stop the bad programs. But we're at a point in our nation's history where we just don't need a Republican that'll babysit America's demise. We actually need someone to undo the damage, which could make you unpopular.
I've been that before.
Oh, have you?
Yeah, I've been that before.
Are you willing, with that in mind, are you willing to be a one-term president?
Absolutely. I think that I've shown that in the Senate I'm willing to stand for a long time and stand up against the vast majority. I can tell you that when I made them stay over Memorial Day to debate the Patriot Act and the NSA, I don't think I was very popular with my colleagues.
All right, one final question for you, Senator. I do appreciate you being here with us this morning. We're grateful for you taking time. And as we have talked about, I think it speaks a lot to those candidates who want to come here and talk to you, share their ideas, their vision for America. And we should take that into consideration when it comes to who we support in this election. As you seek the presidency, you've come to CMP to gain the support of CMP members. Should you be elected, will you pledge to continue this conversation and come back here at future meetings?
That's an easy one. Yes.
All right. Very good. Senator Rand Paul.
Thanks,
thank you so much for being here.